Joe Rogan Experience.
Hey, Joe, so you, well, you say you're probably going to vote for Bernie Sanders, huh?
Hey, you did hit a valid point. His message has been the same consistently for the last 30 years.
Yeah, but Joe, what has that message been, man? The dude's a fucking communist.
He's communist, man.
I mean, I agree with you. You can dig up dirt on anybody.
Yeah.
But, and you can't really find too much dirt on him. Man, if you knew what his message has been in the last 30 years, you already got dirt on him. Besides, have you checked out his website, Joe?
Yeah.
It's a whole lot of dirt on him over there.
Yeah.
It's not hard to find either. It's BernieSanders.com.
Hey, Joe.
Why don't you go check out his website, Joe?
No, I don't check out his website, man.
Hey, see here? Look, we nice guys over here.
Yeah.
Don't waste time. My brother Kevin's gonna read it to you.
Yeah, you say Bernie Sanders is a nice guy. No, we're nice guys. Bernie, he's an asshole.
Hey, listen up, Joe.
Yeah, look at this, man. Look, Medicare for All, man.
Medicare for All.
Create a Medicare for All single-payer national health insurance program to provide everyone in America with comprehensive health care coverage and free at point of service.
Look, Joe, I know what Medicare for All looks like.
Yeah.
I got experience in this, Joe.
Sounds horrible.
Hey, look here. I'm going to tell you this little story. My first bone. My first baby. Yeah. Right? See, my wife's from Mexico, and she recommended this Mexican doctor. Turns out our whole family for like the last 10 years been going to this guy because it's Mexican. It's that Mexican thing, I guess, right? So I said, okay, sounds like a cool doctor. The one thing my wife did not tell me when we went to go see this doctor take my baby because my baby was sick, I did not know this dude, you don't need medical care coverage. You don't need insurance.
Just walk in there, huh?
You just walk in there. All this man wants is his fucking $5. Right?
$5?
That's all he wants.
To see a doctor?
Right? Turns out I go see this man. He's a real doctor now.
I hope he is. It doesn't sound like it. $5.
Right? I go in there. You know what, Joe? I waited 6 hours to see this man. And when I got in there, he said, what's wrong with the baby? I said, well, he's coughing up shit and he won't take his damn bottle. He said, well, you know why? Because he got stomach cramps. Give him some damn tea. And give me my $5 and get the fuck out of my office. And then he was like this. Hey, everybody, keep this damn line moving. That was the worst. I told my wife, I said, we got medical care coverage.
Yeah.
Let's go to Irvine, California. I know this nice. It's a bunch of Asians and white people. They got great programs. Great service. They even got some Mexican doctors now.
Hey, Joe, anything that's worth anything, I found out, anything that's worth anything, it costs money.
Yeah.
If you want good health care, you have to pay money. If you want a good car, you need to pay that money.
Hey.
Anything good, you got to pay for it.
Hey, how these doctors going to get paid, Joe?
Yeah, where's all this money coming from?
These doctors ain't running no damn charity, man. You know how much medical school is?
Hey, you know how he's going to get that money, right?
Hey, listen up, Joe.
Yeah, Joe. You should have checked in with your buddy, Dana White.
Yeah, the guy that signed your rich. Yeah, the guy that signed your paycheck.
He's filthy rich. Bernie's going to tax the shit out of him. If you don't believe me, go ask him. Say, hey, Dana, can I talk to you for a moment? Hey, is Bernie going to tax the shit out of you? He is? Wow, I thought this guy was a good guy.
Yeah, man, it's going to tax the shit out of him. And you know what?
He hates you, too. You're a millionaire, and you're white. He hates all white millionaires. He hates billionaires, too.
Keep going. Let's find some more dirt on Bernie.
Hey, man.
What else we got here?
Look at this, man.
What else we got?
The Green New Deal.
Oh, he stole that from AOC.
Yeah. Listen up, Joe. Look. Transform our energy system to 100% now.
100?
100. That's every job. 100%.
All the energy is 100% renewable energy.
Transform our energy system to 100% renewable energy and create 20 million jobs needed to solve the climate crisis.
Climate crisis?
100%. He's going to take every job in America
make it 100% renewable. 20 million jobs, Joe. What is that? What is he gonna have everybody doing, Joe? Building fucking windmills? You know what's gonna suck, Joe? When the wind stops blowing. Joe, 20 million jobs. 100% of America. He's promising this. He's gonna make everybody's job renewable. Renewable energy. What the hell does that look like, Joe? He's gonna make each and every American a damn galley slave. You're gonna be there rowing boats like this and build, getting electricity. You know what? You're gonna be standing right beside him and say, yeah. You know what, Joe? I told you, you fucking asshole.
Hey, maybe he's gonna, hey, Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, hold on. Hey, maybe he's gonna legalize prostitution. That's the greenest job you can have right now. But the women just...
He's gonna get rid of all the damn cars in the streets. He's gonna build water canals. Everybody's gonna fucking get in a canoe and go to work.
Well, maybe he'll make it like the old West, the horses. Man. Everybody gonna be riding around like Clint Eastwood, man.
Hey, look, it doesn't stop there, Joe. Look.
What else we got?
Housing for all. Oh. He's gonna give everybody a fucking house. Look. In the housing crisis by investing $2.5 trillion. Not million, not billion. He said $2.5 trillion. To build nearly 10 million permanently affordable housing units. You know what that looks like, Joe? He's going to turn the whole United States of America into fucking Section 8 housing. Every home, every neighborhood in America is going to look like Watts.
Hey, Joe. You know what I notice about people when you give them stuff for free, they don't earn it?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to stuff like at a house or a car.
Yeah.
They don't realize what it took to get that car. They got it for free. They tie that shit up, man.
Yeah, like when people ask me for money, I give it to them because they need it. Does that really help them? No. 2 weeks later, hey, man, I need some more money.
Yeah.
Man, I just gave you $200, you broke dick motherfucker. I'll give you this money to get you out of rough spot. Look, that don't mean come to me every 2 weeks asking for more money.
See, what Democrats want to do, instead of teaching you how to fish, they want to go out and get the fish and dangle it in front of you. They be like, you see this fish? You want this fish?
Dance for me.
Dance for me. And after you dance, I want you to vote for me. You don't vote for me, you get shit. Want that damn fish? Like that damn Geico commercial with that dollar. Want this money? Want this fish? Got a vote for me. Yeah, you got a vote for me. Democrats want to turn the average, the typical American citizen into a damn leech.
That's what he wants, Joe. A bunch, he wants America to be asking for a bunch of handouts. And if a government has that power to give you each and everything you need, they got the power to take it away from you. I don't want to hold my destiny in nobody's hand. I take care of my own life, my own housing, my own health care.
Yeah.
I don't allow nobody.
I work hard
for my health care coverage. I work hard for where I want to live and how I want to spend my money. I ain't got to fucking ask Bernie Communist Sanders to take care of me. You know what I'm saying?
What else we got?
Let's see what else.
You know, I'm tired of reading.
Wait a minute.
This
no,
shit.
Man. He's helping some more stuff, man. You know, look, he's got college for all. He's got Medicare for all, the Green New Deal. Look, this is how he wants to keep America safe, Joe. Look, welcoming and safe America for all. Dismantle cruel and inhumane deportation programs and detention centers and reunite families who have been separated. You hear that, Joe? You know what that looks like? He's going to open the damn borders up. He's going to let everybody come and go as you please. Hell, why are you going to stop there? It's a bunch of American families that's been separated because their daddies and mamas, some damn lowlifes out there committing crimes. Gotta let them go too, Joe.
Hey, Joe, I don't believe in letting everybody in this country. Hell, there's people in my family I won't let them come into my house. You gonna just let any Ichabod Crane come into this damn country?
Yeah, that's why.
Come on. We got a bunch of free shit for you.
Yeah, that's why 9/11 happened. That's why you got MS-13 gangs.
You can't let...
These people are not sending their best.
Yeah.
They sit on a bunch of low-life scumbags.
I think that people in these countries, like, especially in Central America, the strong, the people that want to work for what they what they have, they stay in Mexico. They stay in these
and countries. They make Mexico great. They try to make Venezuela great.
They try to make it, but the people, the leeches,
yeah,
you always got leeches in society. Now, I didn't say all of them are leeches, but there's some legitimate refugees out there that need our help. But 90% of these people that's come across our southern border are leeches. They ain't refugees.
And look here, Joe. He's offering a bunch of free shit. The only thing this man is not offering is pussy falls. I mean, it's cool he want to give everybody a damn house. But hey, what's a house without pussy? And look at this, Joe. He said $2.5 trillion to build 10 million homes.
How much is that house? Each house?
Hey, Siri. Hey, wait a minute, man. Let me ask Siri, man. Siri knows everything, man. Listen up, Joe. Hey, Siri, what's $2.5 trillion divided by 10 million?
That would be $250,000.
Bitch, you crazy as hell.
$250,000 a house. That's how much. It shouldn't cost that much.
He don't sound so bad, Joe. He's going to put everybody in castles. But hey, I don't believe him, Joe.
Yeah.
Look what the Hillary Foundation did there in Haiti.
Yeah.
Them niggas still waiting on that house. And they got donated billions of dollars, man.
Hey, Joe.
Those people in Haiti, the Clinton Foundation, they ruined them, man. Them houses look like damn matchboxes. Look like they built them damn houses out of popsicle sticks.
Hey, look here, Joe. Let me say something. Now, look here, Joe.
Yeah.
Now, look, I ain't gonna sit here and tell you not to vote for the man, because this is America.
Yeah.
Now, but Joe, you do us all a favor, man. When you go vote, you keep in mind, motherfucker, this is America. Keep that shit in mind.
A nationally recognized legal analyst and author of Trump Must Win discusses how African Americans feel supported by our president and are speaking out against social justice hypocrisy. One America's Caitlin Sinclair sat down with Tisha Powell to learn more.
There is this term, social justice warrior, that keeps appearing.
Yes.
What does that really mean to you, and why are we seeing it so much right now?
Well, to me, if you're a social justice warrior, you're going to speak up all the time, even if it's going to cost money in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on, LeBron James has been branded a social justice warrior because he did stuff that was really good to help Trevor Martin. However, what's going on in China, LeBron James really disappointed us because he's going to go with what's best for his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people are upset. This is the hypocrisy we are finding with these NFL players, is that when it's their money, they don't want to get involved in it. And this is wrong. This is really wrong.
You wrote a book, Trump Must Win. And can you speak to the research that you did on when it comes to President Trump and his policies? What was the hypocrisy you found between Hollywood and what they actually really stand for?
Well, that's interesting, because I've been a black conservative probably back since 2006. And now that I am like backing President Trump, I'm getting a lot of hate email texts. I'm getting people saying that I'm a racist. I mean, I'm black. How can I be a racist? I mean, I have people going on Amazon all day sending negative comments about the book, all because they don't want people to know that they're black conservatives that are backing Trump. This is really a disappointment in America that black people can't come out and say, I'm for Trump. It is just crazy. I mean, I have black people telling me that I need to get back on the Democratic plantation. I'm like, this is ridiculous. We're living in America. We're free to back who we want. And this is why I had to write this book, because when I was in Europe for the summer, I go Europe all summer, like for the whole, you know, in England, we live better. We live better than the people overseas. And this is what I want to tell American people, that if you back Warren, Biden, and Sanders, we're probably going to be paying 40 to 50% in our taxes. I think that it's important that my community understand that Trump is for everyone. There's a lot of jobs now. There's a lot of health insurance that we're getting. And they really need to go to Trump rally and hear the message. And he's not a racist. There's a lot of black people there. There's a lot of people of all nations voting for Trump. They need to go to the rally and see for themselves. You can't just watch the liberal media. Trump is for all races, including black people.
the right to legally bargain. We have the right to organize. We have the right to strike. So yeah, there ain't gonna be no McCafe today, McMuffin.
All right.
Creating the next generation of folks that's going to need human dignity at the workplace. Right. You are there every day, you see it. If it ain't sexual harassment, if it ain't having to not know what your hours are last minute, to get a supervisor inappropriate, doesn't know he or she's what they're doing, all of it, the way you're treated by your own customers. You know how bad it is to be working on the front line with all the service industry. They are making record profits every single day from your labor. I'm sorry, but Americans, they want you to have human dignity and rights at the workplace. So they know they'll pay even a little more so that you can be taken care of. But we don't even need to. They already make enough. And they should be able to take care of you at the workplace. All of you. We want the right job. I want you to know corporate disease in our country is a disease. It is a disease. And you are going to stop it. You are. I promise you, you are the cure to corporate disease in our country. Because you're not doing it alone. You're doing it collectively. Together. And I'll tell you, that is so powerful. This is what they're afraid of, y'all. Like, you don't understand. This is what they're afraid of. All of it. When you walk out, they lose money.
That's
so
right.
Walk out.
That's right.
Walk
That's
out. Right. Walk out. Right. Walk out. And you'll see how it will change. And your lives will be better. I promise you that. People are not going to believe that somebody worked at McDonald's got full-time health care. Has rights to organize. Has $15 an hour. It is a snow day, but not for us today in Detroit. We're still going to go out there because this is the city of movements. Yes. We birth movements. And if there's a place to start this movement, it is the city of Detroit.
All right.
So here we're on page 3. Anybody look like you say yes,
huh? Oh, I don't know. I'm not. You know what? And also, analysts need to be African Americans, not people that are not. Because let me tell you, no, it happens all the time. Okay. It's true. Okay. I think non-African Americans think African Americans all look the same. I've seen it even on the house floor, people calling Elijah Cummings John Lewis and John Lewis Elijah Cummings, and they're totally different people. I'm just saying. I see it all the time, and I love them because they like go along with it.
Well, I trust people who are trained.
I know.
Regardless of race, regardless of gender. It's about the training.
But it does make a huge difference.
So, it does.
Marxist? Are you a conspiracy theorist?
I think my politics are entirely irrelevant to this hearing.
Oh, okay. Why were you winking at one of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle? You winked.
Because I know Glenn Grossman.
Oh, that's what... So the winking... Did he...
He introduced me. Oh, he's a friend of mine.
Okay, I understand. I didn't know what the winking was, because I thought maybe there was something like a conspiracy thing going on there. I didn't know.
You think there's a conspiracy in this hearing, ma'am?
No, I actually think people are speaking truth here, and you can provide information.
May I address the truth?
No.
Well, the truth to you is very different for the majority of people in this room who do believe that children are being
targeted. The truth for me is I quit smoking with these cigarettes, and so did 8 million other people.
You're still smoking.
I'm not smoking.
Thank you.
And I'm not lying under oath.
Order, please.
You guys are crazy!
You're an animal! Get a job!
Rashida! We are all Rashida!
Asking if I can duck. Honestly, I've never felt more Palestinian than I ever felt in Congress. Even in Palestine, when I'm visiting my grandmother, I'm more American, like to the Palestinian. But I'm more Palestinian in the halls of Congress than I am anywhere in the country, in the world. And that just tells you just the fact that they weren't ready for us. They really weren't, but we were ready for this.
Because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they aren't racist. And it is insensitive that some would even say It's the fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself. Donald Trump is setting
Mr.
precedent.
Chairman, I ask that her words
Donald
be
Trump
taken
is setting
down.
A precedent. I reclaim my time.
Mr.
Donald
Chairman,
Trump is setting a precedent.
Mr. Chairman,
that the highest office can be attained.
Mr. Chairman, the rules are clear.
Mr. Chairman, I yield the rest of my time.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that her words, when she's referring to an individual member of this body, be taken down and stricken from the record. I'm sure she didn't intend to do this. But if anyone knows my record as it relates, it should be you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to...
Hold on.
I want the words read
back. No.
We want to know exactly what she said about a colleague.
Excuse me. Would you like to rephrase that statement, Ms. Tlaib?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can actually read it from here. Just to make a note, Mr. Chairman, that just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they are racist. And it is insensitive that someone would even say it is racist in itself, and to use a black woman as a prop to prove it otherwise. And I can submit this for the record. If a colleague is thinking that that's what I'm saying, I'm just saying that's what I believe to have happened. And if, as a person of color in this committee, that's how I felt at that moment, and I wanted to express that. But I am not calling the gentleman, Mr. Meadows, a racist for doing so. I'm saying that in itself, it is a racist act.
Well, I hope not, Mr. Chairman, because I need to be clear on this particular... Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Meadows, wait a minute.
I've defended you with false accusations.
Mr. Meadows, I'm the chair.
Yes, sir, you are.
Thank you. Right. I will clear this up. Now, Ms. Tlaib, I want to make sure I understand. You were not intending to call Mr. Meadows a racist, is that right?
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not call Mr. Meadows a racist. No, I am trying, as a person of color, Mr. Chairman, just to express myself and how I felt at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so, just for the record, that's what was my intention.
All right. Mr. Meadows.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing more personal to me than my relationship. My nieces and nephews are people of color. Not many people know that. You know that, Mr. Chairman. And to indicate that I asked someone who is a personal friend of the Trump family, who has worked for him, who knows this particular individual, that she's coming in to be a prop, it's racist to suggest that I ask her to come in here for that reason. Mr. President, the president's own person. She's a family member. She loves this family. She came in because she felt like the president of the United States was getting falsely accused. And Mr. Chairman, you and I have a personal relationship that's not based on color. And to even go down this direction is wrong, Mr. Chairman.
First of all, did you have a statement, Ms. Tlaib? I'm going to yield to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to my colleague, Mr. Meadows, that was not my intention, and I do apologize if that's what it sounded like, but I said... Past year, I realized, my, are they obsessed with our bodies, how we talk, how we look, what we stand for? I mean, this type of policing of our bodies is so interconnected to all the social justice movements all around the country. I represent the third poorest congressional district in the country. This issue is an economic justice issue. This issue is a racial justice issue. And let me tell you, this obsession with our bodies. You know, I in the legislature, in the Michigan legislature for 6 years, used to say to people, yo, you know what? You're so freaking obsessed with what I decide to do with my body, maybe you shouldn't even want to have sex with me, or with you, or with any woman. The power that we have over our bodies to push back and use that power and saying, enough is enough, we won't stand by for you to commercialize, for you to profit, for you to do all the things you do to what? To make us less than in this country, because that's what it does. So I want you to know there is more of us than them. That someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself. Donald Trump is setting
Mr. Chairman, I ask that her words Donald be Trump taken down. Donald Trump
is setting a president. I reclaim my time.
Mr. Donald Chairman.
Trump is setting a president.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cohen, with this, do you think the president of the United States is making decisions in the best interest of the American people?
No, I don't.
Especially those you said that he used horrible words about, like African Americans, Muslim Americans, and immigrants?
Yes.
Just to make a note, Mr. Chairman, just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they aren't racist. And it is insensitive that some would even say it's the fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself. Donald Trump is setting
Mr.
President.
Chairman, I ask that her words
Donald
be
Trump
taken
is setting
down.
A president. I reclaim my time.
Mr.
Donald
Chairman,
Trump is setting a president.
Mr. Chairman,
that the highest office can be a
Mr. Chairman, the rules are clear.
Equity. Cover up and hold on to business assets to break campaign finance laws and constitutional clauses. What we have here, Mr. Chairman, is criminal conduct and the pursuit of the highest public office by Mr. Cohen and individual one. I hope that the gravity of this situation hits everyone in this body,
the court report,
and in Congress and across this country. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield the rest of my time.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that her words, when she's referring to an individual member of this body, be taken down and stricken from the record. I'm sure she didn't intend to do this, but if anyone knows my record as it relates, it should be you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I would like to
hold on.
I want the words read
back.
We want to know exactly what she said about a colleague.
Excuse me. Would you like to rephrase that statement, Ms. Saleeb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can actually read it from here. Just to make a note, Mr. Chairman, that just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they are racist. And it is insensitive that someone would even say it is racist in itself, and to use a black woman as a prop to prove it otherwise. And I can submit this for the record. If a colleague is thinking that that's what I'm saying, I'm just saying that's what I believe to have happened. And if, as a person of color in this committee, that's how I felt at that moment, and I wanted to express that. But I am not calling the gentleman, Mr. Meadows, a racist for doing so. I'm saying that in itself, it is a racist act.
Well, I hope not, Mr. Chairman, because I need to be clear on this particular. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meadows, wait a minute.
I've defended you with false accusations.
Mr. Meadows, I'm the chair.
Yes, sir, you are.
Thank you. Right. I will clear this up. Now, Ms. Saleeb, I want to make sure I understand. You were not intending to call Mr. Meadows a racist. Is that right?
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not call Mr. Meadows a racist. No, I am trying, as a person of color, Mr. Chairman, just to express myself and how I felt at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so, just for the record, that's what was my intention.
All right. Mr. Meadows.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing more personal to me than my relationship. My nieces and nephews are people of color. Not many people know that. You know that, Mr. Chairman. And to indicate that I asked someone who is a personal friend of the Trump family, who has worked for him, who knows this particular individual, that she's coming in to be a prop, it's racist to suggest that I ask her to come in here for that reason. Mr. President, the president's own person. She's a family member. She loves this family. She came in because she felt like the president of the United States was getting falsely accused. And Mr. Chairman, you and I have a personal relationship that's not based on color. And to even go down this direction is wrong, Mr. Chairman.
First of all, I want to thank the gentleman for what you have stated. If there's anyone who is sensitive with regard to race, it's me. Son of former sharecroppers that were basically slaves. So I get it. I listened very carefully to Ms. Saleeb. And I think, and I don't want to, I'm not going to put words in her mouth, but I think she said that she was not calling you a racist. And I thought that we could clarify that. Because you, Mr. Meadows, you know, and of all the people on this committee, I've said it and got in trouble for it, that you're one of my best friends. I know that shocks a lot of people.
And likewise, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
But you are. And I would do, and I could see and feel your pain. I feel it. And so, and I don't think Ms. Salib intended to cause you that kind of pain and that kind of frustration. Did you have a statement, Ms. Salib? I'm going to yield to you. We
no,
can just straighten
you,
this
Mr.
up.
Mr. Chairman, and to my colleague, Mr. Meadows, that was not my intention, and I do apologize if that's what it sounded like, but I said someone in general. And as everybody knows in this chamber, I'm pretty direct, so if I wanted to say that, I would have, but that's not what I said. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to clarify. But again, I said someone. And again, that was not referring to you at all as a racist.
Well, I thank the gentlewoman for her comments. I thank the chairman for working to clarify this. And I appreciate the chairman's intervening.
Now to the gentleman, first of all, thank you for allowing us to resolve that.
White to you? We need to get it right because I'm not white. I'm not. And based on the findings, the Census Bureau recommended the inclusion of MENA category in the 2020 census. Despite these findings, however, the Census Bureau announced under the current administration that MENA category would not be included in the census. Dr. Dillingham, do I look white to you?
Congresswoman, I think that if you tell me what you identify with, and I think I would respect that.
Sure. So, Dr. Director, are you aware that people like me who are Arab, Middle Eastern, North African have to indicate that they're white on the U.S. Census?
Congresswoman, we actually have on the, I understand, you know, that there was a process in deciding, certainly before I got to the census, and there's a history to coming up with the questions and the race and the ethnicity categories, and that OMB...
No, they ignored it. But they ignored it. The previous administration decided to put MENA on the form. They ignored it. But do you think if I circled white category, that would be an accurate depiction of my racial and ethnic background?
Congresswoman, we do not second guess what you put down
okay.
there.
Okay.
We do have a write-in.
Director, people can write. You're not giving me an option, because let me tell you, there's a reason why the recommendation happened. Sure. Because would circling white on the census change my lived experience as a person of color in our country? Right? Even saying that, you understand there's a difference when you actually have the checkoff box.
That's right.
Because the MENA community, like others, relies on accurate census representation for health research, director,
sure,
language assistant, civil rights laws, and reporting educational outcomes. In addition, it would help address things like crime reporting, director, helping minority business owners get loans, and drawing congressional and state legislative boundaries. So, director, do you believe it is important to better collect racial and race information from census participants of Middle Eastern and North African descent?
Congresswoman,
I
can say that by having the write-in provision, that is the
option.
Sir,
it doesn't have the same impact, and you know that. You know that. No. That's why the community pushed to add the category of MENA, and they did it right. They went through the process, and they got it approved. And this administration decided to ignore them and to make them invisible again, right? That's what you're doing. You're making us invisible. No. The continued absence of this ethnic category contributes to erasing us, our living, working, we all live and work and raise our families here. I truly believe this issue needs to be addressed, and we need your leadership to push back against this current administration's lack of wanting to see people like me being represented on an official government federal form that decides around funding, decides how they're going to treat us, how they're going to approach health research, language assistance, all those kinds of things. And I mean, you know, director, we need to get it right because I'm not white. I'm not. And I don't try to say to others that you should be this or that. But when I sit on this forum and I look at it, I don't see myself represented on this form. And I think that's a huge issue for people like me. Sure. And I need you to do more in pushing back against this current administration, ignoring what the previous administration was able to do. And the U.S. Census Bureau decided to add MENA, and they ignored it.
Congresswoman, I can assure you that we continue to study race and ethnicity and the options for self-reporting that.
Director?
And let me just say that. We want your views, and we're beginning the process of looking at the 2030 census.
It's too late because for 10 years, we will be invisible to health research, to a number of things, small business loans. We will be invisible for another decade in our country. And I think it's wrong. And it was wrong to ignore the efforts of not only the Office of Management and Budget, but organizations like Access AI and others who followed the process, did what they needed to get public input to making sure that they are seen finally by their own federal government. Thank you, I yield.
Buy into our values and thrive. We call it the American dream, and nothing makes us prouder. It was in that spirit that in 1992, the United States welcomed 10-year-old Ilhan Omar and her family. Omar was born in Somalia, one of the world's poorest countries. It was then ruled by a Marxist military dictatorship. When Omar was six, she and her parents and their six siblings fled a worsening civil war and wound up in a refugee camp in Kenya. They spent 4 years there until America offered the family asylum here and let them settle in Minneapolis. Omar's father drove a taxi at first, then got a job at the post office working for the government. Omar, meanwhile, grew up free in the world's richest country with all the bounty that that implies. She became a citizen, then went to work at a state university. A few years later, she became a member of Congress, elected by voters who were proud to see an immigrant succeed. Omar is now, at the age of only 36, one of the most powerful women in America. It's an amazing story, really. Only in this country could it have happened. Ilhan Omar has an awful lot to be grateful for. But she isn't grateful, not at all. After everything America has done for Omar and for her family, she hates this country more than ever. In a recent piece in the Washington Post, the reporter put it this way, quote, in Omar's version, America isn't the big-hearted country that saved her from a brutal war in a bleak refugee camp. It wasn't a meritocracy that helped her attend college or vaulted her into Congress. Instead, it was the country that had failed to live up to its founding ideals, a place that had disappointed her and so many immigrants, refugees, and minorities like her, end quote. If anything, that's an understatement. Omar isn't disappointed in America. She's enraged by it. Virtually every public statement she makes accuses Americans of bigotry and racism. This is an immoral country, she says. She has undisguised contempt for the United States and for its people. That should worry you, and not just because Omar is now a sitting member of Congress. Ilhan Omar is living proof that the way we practice immigration has become dangerous to this country. A system designed to strengthen America is instead undermining it. Some of the very people we try hardest to help have come to hate us passionately. Maybe that's our fault for asking too little of our immigrants. We aren't self-confident enough to make them assimilate so they never feel fully American. Or maybe the problem is deeper than that. Maybe we're importing people from places whose values are simply antithetical to ours. Who knows what the problem is? But there is a problem. And whatever the cause, this cannot continue. It's not sustainable. No country can import large numbers of people who hate it and expect to survive. The Romans were the last to try that with predictable results. So be grateful for Ilhan Omar, annoying as she is. She's a living fire alarm, a warning to the rest of us that we better change our immigration system immediately. Or else. We want to end tonight with some good news. Last night we told you about Ed Henry and his decision to save.
We saw this pro-abortion rally to protest the case that's coming up yesterday. It was outside the Supreme Court. This woman, here's an abortion activist. This woman, listen to the tone of her voice. Listen, even beyond the arguments she's making, listen simply to how she sounds. Tells you a lot about the abortion issue.
Where are the abortion providers at? Where are the future abortion providers at? Woo! Awesome. And a special shout out to where are my people who had abortions? Where y'all at? Nothing about this work is gonna be without us. Woo! Awesome. So
As I said, I had an abortion when I was 19. It was honestly one of the best decisions of my life. I was simply not ready to become a parent, and that's really all you need to know.
Hey, lady, who are you trying to convince? Who are you trying to convince? I mean, you just see her. She's so strained. She's so pushing this narrative out there. I'm so happy that I killed my child. What a great decision I made. I definitely don't regret that, and it hasn't really damaged my life. I mean, anybody with eyes and ears can see that this is a tortured woman. You hear it in her voice, the shrieking, the screaming, the tension in what she's saying. Of course. I mean, look, people make mistakes all the time, okay? If you make a mistake, even if it's a mistake that bad, you can regret it, ask forgiveness, move on. But these people can't. They can't get over the pride and the horror that they may have committed such an egregious act. And it's not just one or two random activists. I mean, political activists, generally, they can be sort of eccentric people, right? But it's the same sort of tone of voice. It's the same kind of shrill, angry, tense, incredible tone that you see with congressmen and with senators when they do it. Rashida Tlaib, one of the members of the squad, goes out there, the exact same rally, same tone of voice, same ridiculous arguments.
Past year, I realized, my, are they obsessed with our bodies, how we talk, how we look, what we stand for? I mean, this type of policing of our bodies is so interconnected to all the social justice movements all around the country. I represent the third poorest congressional district in the country. This issue is an economic justice issue. This issue is a racial justice issue. And let me tell you, this obsession with our bodies. You know, I, in the legislature, in the Michigan legislature for 6 years, used to say to people, yo, you know what? You're so freaking obsessed with what I decide to do with my body. Maybe you shouldn't even want to have sex with me or with you or with any woman.
Hold on. Pause it right there. I just need to correct the record before Rashida Tlaib continues. That is not something I have ever wanted to do. Not that is of all the things that one could imagine doing with Rashida Tlaib, that is not one of them. So please do not accuse me of ever wanting to do that. That on the things of the list of things I want to do, just in general in the world, that is very, very far down near the bottom. She goes on.
The power that we have over our bodies to push back and use that power and saying enough is enough. We won't stand by for you to commercialize, for you to profit, for you to do all the things you do to what? To make us less than in this country. Because that's what it does. So I want you to know there is more of us than them.
And there it is. That's her whole argument, right? She's making all of these really stupid, slogan-y arguments. They're like bumper stickers. They don't mean anything. When she says, we want to control our bodies. No, they don't. I mean, anybody who is even somewhat honest about the abortion issue would say it's not about your body that people are concerned. It's the child's body. So it isn't that. They say it's about making us less than. No, it's about we don't think you should kill babies. That's what it's about. you can try to argue that when you say it's we have to be able to kill babies for equality, but at least be honest about the issue. So she puts out these slogans, and then she finally gets to her real argument, which is there's more of us than there are of them. It's not a moral argument. There's more of us than them. It's not an argument from justice, or it's not ethical at all. You're just saying that you're a mob and you're going to force your will on other people. Justice be damned. Unborn baby be damned. Who cares? You're just going to do it. This was actually the subject of my talk last night at UC Santa Cruz. I was giving a talk on when democracy goes wrong. When democracy goes wrong is when people start making arguments like this, which is there's more of us than them. That's not coherent. I mean, I guess any mob, any lynch mob in the world can go and effect their will on somebody. That doesn't make it right. You've got to argue beyond that. But Rashida Tlaib can't. Why? I don't know anything about Rashida Tlaib's past. I just know about her political ideology. And I know that she is trying to convince a lot of people, maybe herself, of this argument that is untenable. It's indefensible. It's why she gets shrill. It's why she shrieks. It's why she makes these slogan arguments that fall flat. And it's eventually why she says, I want it. I mean, that's what that means, right? There's more of us than them. Is I want it. I'm going to do it. Me, 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 me. And not very convincing to the
apology. The apology that she had, she wrote, anti-Semitism is real. I am grateful for Jewish allies and colleagues who are educating me on the painful history of anti-Semitic tropes. My intention is never to offend my constituents or Jewish Americans as a whole. We have to always be willing to step back and think through criticism, just as I expect people to hear me when others attack me for my identity. I unequivocally apologize. But if you thought there was going to be another shooter drop here, you're right. And this is where it really gets like into crazy town. Doubly. She says, at the same time, I reaffirm the problematic role of lobbyists in our politics, whether it be AIPAC, the NRA, or the fossil fuel industry. It's gone on too long, and we have to be willing to address it. So she's suggesting that somehow AIPAC is a monumentally huge lobbyist organization when they're not even one of the top 100 organizations. And as I just said, they're a 501c4. So if she's suggesting that Kevin McCarthy is being paid by AIPAC to be pro-Israel, that completely goes against their tax structure. Furthermore, where it concerns the NRA, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, why are you bringing the NRA as into it? I mean, these are just Americans who want to organize under a banner of common cause to inform their elected leaders what is important to them. So I guess what, now we have to defend our First Amendment right along with our Second Amendment right? Or does Representative Omar believe that the First Amendment and the Second Amendment should only be afforded to those people who think exactly as she does? So this is incredibly problematic for a sitting elected official to say this. And I don't believe that her apology is sincere. She's learned nothing from her last apology. In fact, she's tweeted some pretty crazy things before. The other time, let me pull this up because I have all this stuff in front of me. She tweeted once, Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel. Hashtag Gaza, hashtag Palestine, hashtag Israel. This is like the second time in 3 weeks that she has gone on this like anti-Semitic kind of rampage. Which is, again, she sits on the Foreign Policy Committee. And she's also, by the way, still scheduled to speak at the end of this month with a notorious anti-Semite who has called Jews lots of things and even celebrated, like, the death of Jewish people. So, yeah, this is a hugely problematic. So it's an insincere apology because she learned nothing from her last apology, and she keeps saying this crazy sort of stuff. And why even bring the NRA into it? Which, by the way, the NRA has a lot of Jewish members, just FYI. And to say something like this after and contribute to this climate of hatefulness, especially so soon after the Tree of Life synagogue massacre, that doesn't help anything. We're trying to calm the hate down, not fan the flames. So this sort of rhetoric from a sitting elected official does absolutely nothing to help that. So she does not need to attack a group of 5 million Americans. She does not need to go after gun owners and put them in this as well, who are, by the way, the most law-abiding people in the country that she claims to represent. And by the way, in her state of Minnesota, I don't know if she's aware, but 36.7% of these people are gun owners, and she just attacked every single one of them with this hateful rhetoric. So, yeah, I think she needs to listen closely before she attacks law-abiding gun owners, because this is, I mean, I'm just looking at this, it's just awful. And like I said, this is the third time in 3 weeks that she's had to walk back anti-Semitic remarks, and it's a non-apology, and CARE's also a lobbyist group. There, I could run down a list of lobbyist groups. I don't understand what she has against people who want to organize under that banner of common cause. The NRA is one of the oldest civil rights organizations in America, and we've been fighting for the rights of all Americans.
When we, you know, have this discussion about going back or reopening, I think a lot of people should just say, no, we're not going back to that. We're not going back to working 70-hour weeks just so that we could put food on the table and not even feel any sort of semblance of security in our lives.
We have to look back at how the left has treated this coronavirus pandemic from the very beginning. When you have Jim Clyburn, when he said that this pandemic can be used as an opportunity to radically reshape the United States in the way that we see fit moving forward, he meant it. When AOC goes on Instagram Live and when she does these social media things and when she says some things like people should not go back to work, they mean it. What you're seeing right now is the people on the left using this as an opportunity to reshape the world in a radical socialist agenda. They do not want people to go back to work. They do not want the millions of small business owners to do what they need to do to open back up their businesses, because they would rather people be dependent on the state and be dependent on the government. This is why, at the very beginning, they pushed the stimulus package that had a whole lot of pork and a whole lot of far left agenda items that had nothing to do with helping the American people. This is about people that are in positions of power in the Democratic Party telling people not to go back to work because they want to control them through massive government intervention and using this pandemic to do so. Not everything is about the president. Sometimes it is about the politicians in charge on the left trying to reshape America into the socialist state that they want and using the pandemic.
Today we're here to highlight the human costs of the occupation and travel restrictions on Palestinians and others. As many of you know, I had planned to travel to Israel and Palestine to hear from individuals on the ground about the conflict so that I could be more informed as a member of Congress and as a member on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Contrary to many media reports and the statements of the Israeli Prime Minister, I plan to meet directly with members of the Knesset and Israeli security, along with Palestinian civil society groups, former IDF soldiers, Israel, Palestine, and international organizations, and United Nations officials. Leading up to the trip, I met with constituents holding a wide range of views on the conflict. All the activities on my trip had been done by members of Congress in the past, including a nearly identical trip few years ago led by the very same Palestinian organization leading this trip. In addition to me and Rashida going on the trip, we were going to be joined by Stacy Plaskett from the Virgin Islands. The decision to ban me and my colleague, the first two Muslim American women elected to Congress, is nothing less than an attempt by an ally of the United States to suppress our ability to do our jobs as elected officials. But this is not just about me. Netanyahu's decision to deny us entry might be unprecedented for members of Congress, but it is the policy of his government when it comes to Palestinians. This is the policy of his government when it comes to anyone who holds views that threaten the occupation, a policy that has been edged on and supported by Trump's administration. That's because the only way to preserve unjust policy is to suppress people's freedom of expression, freedom of association, and freedom of movement. My colleague and I are not the only ones who are being denied the right to see for ourselves the reality on the ground on the West Bank. The Netanyahu government, for example, is currently trying to deport Omar Shakir, a human rights worker with Human Rights Watch, because he has reported on human rights conditions in the West Bank and Gaza. Last year, the Netanyahu government refused entry to American citizen Catherine Frank and my friend Vince Warren, who had arrived on a human rights mission. All of these actions do nothing to bring us closer to peace. In fact, they do the opposite. They maintain the occupation and prevent a solution to the conflict. Fortunately, we in the United States have a constructive role to play. We give Israel more than $3 million in aid every year. This is predicated on their being an important ally in the region and the only democracy in the Middle East. But denying visit to duly elected members of Congress is not consistent with being an ally, and denying millions of people freedom of movement or expression or self-determination is not consistent with being a democracy. We must be asking, as Israel's ally, the Netanyahu government, stop the expansion of settlements on Palestinian land and ensure full rights for Palestinians if we are to give them aid.
We need to completely dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department. The Minneapolis Police Department is rotten to the root. And so when we dismantle it, we get rid of that cancer.
The vast majority of men and women in law enforcement across our country are not evil, are not racist, do not wake up every morning looking for violence. We're reminded of their bravery every time a citizen needs to dial 911 and they rush toward danger. And we were all reminded again this past weekend as these professionals bravely kept watch over demonstrations, including ones where they themselves have been called racist or evil or denigrated in the worst ways because of their uniform and their badge. So, Mr. President, if peaceful protesters rightly do not want to be lumped in with a subset of looters and rioters who seek destruction, then the vast majority of brave police officers cannot be lumped in with the very worst examples of heinous behavior. It's that simple. But instead, we're already seeing outlandish calls, defund the police, or abolish the police, take root within the left-wing leadership class. The president of the city council in Minneapolis has proclaimed she can imagine a future without police. One of her fellow council members put it even more clearly. This council is going to dismantle this police department. To be clear what this effort is about, one of the local groups informing this push in Minnesota has literally stated that arts programs and mental health resources will be more effective at stopping crime than armed cops. Instead of, quote, dangers armed with guns, they say other professionals like social workers should be the ones to, quote, respond to crises in our community. I'm all for social work and mental health. But call me old-fashioned. I think you may actually want a police officer to stop a criminal and arrest him before we try to work through his feelings. Well, even if some left-wing leaders fall for this nonsense, I have a feeling the American people are too smart for that. They know that what happened to George Floyd is totally abhorrent. They also know that riots and looting are unacceptable. And they also know that well-trained law enforcement officers are an important part of creating safe communities, not something to defund or abolish. So I'm proud that Americans across the country can protest in safety and peace. I'm proud that their neighbors continue to answer the call to protect and to serve. And I'm hopeful that with unity and mutual respect, we can continue this important national discussion to ensure justice and equal protection under the law.
We must recognize that these systems